Harris. I hope that you all are having a wonderful Christmas season. I know I am, although the snow did melt. We had a bunch of snow yesterday, and now I'm looking outside and I see hardly any. So hopefully we'll get some more before Christmas time. But we have a special episode for you today, and I've had a number of people over probably the last year reach out to me and tell me, hey, you got to get this guy, Chris LeDuc, on your podcast. And not Chris LeDoux, the country singer. Some of you, probably 10 of you knew who I was talking about there. But Chris LeDoux, the pastor, who has been involved with, I struggle this to figure out which term I want to use, but we're just going to say Christian nationalism. I know we've talked about it on the podcast. I know it's a hot button term for some of you, but this is a twist, right? Because Pastor Chris LeDoux is actually a dispensationalist. And he is a graduate of the Master Seminary in Sun Valley, California, where John MacArthur is the president. And despite that, he actually is not afraid to say, hey, I'm a Christian nationalist. I'm for that kind of stuff. And he has a YouTube series called How Should We Then Think, or a channel called How Should We Then Think, where he talks about this. And I'll say last, before we introduce him, that he was also referenced, although not by name, in the documentary about Grace Community Church and their stand on COVID. And when they reversed course and decided to open up the church, he was instrumental in influencing some of the leadership in that. So without further ado, thank you for coming on the podcast, Pastor Chris LeDuc. We appreciate it.
Hey, John. Good to talk with you. I've listened to you for a bunch of years, so it's fun to sit and be able to have an exchange.
Likewise. Well, I'm admiring your office as I was beforehand, and you have a great wall of books there with some great heroes of the faith over them. And, you know, I was thinking about some of the Christmas time maybe does this, but some of the rich heritage that we have as Christians. We have such a rich heritage going back to millennium with amazing thinkers. And so often it seems that we, and I speak we in a very figurative sense there here, but we want to reinvent the wheel, right? There's guys who have actually thought through some of the issues that we're facing. But we want to go back to, I don't know what you even call it, like a blank slate kind of biblicist. You know, I'm going to just sit in my room, figure out from the Bible, which I admire Bible study, of course, and so forth. But some of the debates that we're having now seem to be very similar to debates that have happened in the past, especially during the Reformation, when there was a question about the extent to which the church and the state should interact with one another and have authority and that kind of thing. And I know this is some of what you've dealt with, and so I want to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you also about maybe, I don't know if you have a unique spin on the civil magistrate because of your dispensationalism. I know we were talking about this a little beforehand, that some folks reduce everything down to eschatology, which I don't think I go with, but I'd love to get your thought on that, because I keep hearing that dispensationalists cannot be Christian nationalists. So why don't we start here? What made you decide that you wanted to tackle this subject, and what made you interested in the extent to which the magistrate and the ecclesiastic branch interact and have authority and that kind of thing?
Yeah. That's a good question. Well, in one sense, you know, I've always been kind of interested in that topic, you know, coming to faith later in life, you know, and being somewhat of a rebel as a kid, you know, you finally come to Christ, and now, you know, at least for me, I was very serious about my submission to Christ and obedience. And so that opened a lot of questions. And just over my years of study, you know, when you combine a good anthropology, right, man, not good, a good anthropology with a little bit of understanding of even our own government, you know, and all the different things, horrible things our government has done, you know, whether it's the CIA or whoever, there's a healthy distrust. And then the question is, but I still need to be in submission. And so what does that look like? But COVID is really obviously what kind of brought this to the front for everybody. And, you know, when I left Grace Community Church and the seminary, got sent out with Grace Advance, was pastoring a Grace Advance church in Oregon. We had the same doctrinal statement as Grace Church did. And there's a section in there that talks about how the local church is an autonomous entity, you know, free from interference by any other sphere. And so, you know, I always believed that, yeah, you know, and this is where even definitions get important. One of the big one of the big ways language, imprecise language has been really harmful is talking about using the word church to refer to Christians in general, right? Because, and Martin Lloyd-Jones talks about this in that kind of now infamous Romans 13 commentary, that introduces the old muddle. The church has certain roles, and then individual Christians have certain roles. And so we talk about, well, it's not the job of the church to engage culture. Okay, fine, whatever. How about the job of individual Christians to engage culture, right? But so many people use that term church to encompass both the institution, the organized body, and the individuals. So, and the roles are different, right? I, as an individual, I don't baptize people, you know, those types of things. I don't serve the sacraments as an individual outside of the church. So, when March 2020 came around, I already was under the understanding that the church, when we assemble, we are an autonomous entity, right? We're under the lordship of Christ. We're not under another sphere. And I quickly found myself in the minority position when we stayed open. And some of it was just prep from even, I think, Paul Washer, Watch and Heart Cry Missionary Society. They were sending out updates from Wuhan all the way back in 2009 or 2019. And so our men's group, we had already looked at some of the pictures they were sending out and saying, you know, we see what these guys are in hazmat suits, passing out tracts, doing what they're supposed to do. And so we had talked about, hey, if it comes here, we're just, you know, the cost might be high, but we're going to do what we're supposed to do. And so when everybody shuts down and we stay open, and then I find that, you know, even my sending church, who I share a doctrinal statement with, tells me I'm wrong. And I know Romans 13 doesn't say anything about Caesar having authority over the local church. It's at that point that I'm realizing, all right, we got a big problem here, because nobody seems to know Protestant, you know, political theory. Very few people can address Romans 13 out of a commentary that's more than 50 years old. So that, and I realized, listen, it was almost easier to say, I know what Romans 13 doesn't teach, then I know what it does teach. I know it doesn't teach Caesar has authority over the local church. Mm-hmm. And so that was really what triggered it for me was 2020. And then seeing how much resistance there was to staying open. And I don't know if that helps a little bit.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you had a solid view about how to navigate that particular scenario before it happened. So you're telling me, though, you actually were forced into it at the beginning of it. And that's when you figured out where these lines were. But before that, I mean, I was expecting you to say something like, well, I was interested in politics and decided to go the ministry mm-hmm. route or something like that. But it sounds like, no, you actually were studying and reading and in reaction to something that, and that's what spurred you to land at the conclusions you did.
Yeah. I'm just trying to ask the question of, you know, what does it look like to express the lordship of Christ wherever I go, whatever sphere I enter into. And so even, you know, as I think about as a local church elder, you know, using pastor elder synonymously, I'm here at the local church. Caesar says, shut down. Christ has said, feed my sheep. And I'm thinking, I've not been delegated the authority to turn away members in good standing from assembling and partaking of the ordinances. Christ hasn't delegated that authority to me, right? So if all these civil magistrates want to be tyrants, I'm not going to be a tyrant. Right. And so that really, you know, directed me to study, okay, how really does divinely delegated authority work in spheres with its limitations and teleology and all that? And so, it just forced my hand to where, listen, I'm not going to turn you away. I asked everybody, what do you guys want to do at our church? And what do you mean what we want to do? We're going to do what we're supposed to do. We're going to keep gathering and, you know, you're going to keep teaching. Yeah, amen.
So the guys who have reached out to me separately, I think without knowing it, and said, yeah, you got to have this guy on, are very excited about the fact that I think they feel the ability. They don't feel like hampered by dispensationalism. And they think that you're an example of this, that you've given them the go ahead, that they can believe in Christian nations. And we haven't even gotten into that yet, but we've just talked about the COVID issue, but they can navigate that. And they don't have to be told that because they're a dispensationalist, they can't be involved in politics. That seems to be it to me. It's like, we can be involved as Christians despite our eschatology. Maybe talk about that for a moment, because I do hear a lot of people, but it's, and I told you beforehand, it's not so much the Amil crowd, but there's a certain, it's only a certain strain in my mind of post-mill who tend to be very influenced by Reconstruction theonomy kind of stuff. And they will say, yeah, that's the bane issue. That's the problem, is that Christians are affected by dispensationalism. And if we didn't have this, then we could really do some good. And I know I said beforehand, we started recording that I had Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and James Dobson, all these guys, founding fathers of the religious right, and even their the people who've taken over from them, their descendants, as it were, like Matt Staver and who else did I mention? The various Christian groups that are out there, they seem to also be in that same line. They're dispensational as well, or they cater to that crowd. And they're the ones that they're the game in town, in my mind. You know, I don't see a lot of post-mill guys channeling those efforts into actual political endeavors. It's very few. So I know that's a long way of framing this and setting it up, but you know, you as someone who is a dispensationalist by conviction, how do you justify your, what you just described as your political position, and what do you think about that whole argument?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things, and you know, you and I talked a little bit about this, is let's just be consistent. If we're going to make arguments, take them to their inescapable conclusions. And so one of the things I even like to say is, listen, if you want to compare eschatologies, and if we want to blame the current state of affairs on current eschatologies, let's go look at Europe. You really want to go there? Dispensationalism wasn't where the Reformation happened, right? And how are they doing? So let's not go there. You know, with dispensationalism, there's a lot of presuppositions that are brought into the political theology, right? So, and as I have said, I like to start the argument with talking about premillennial complementarianism. Tell me how premillennial complementarianism is different from all-mill or post-mill complementarianism. And it's not, because complementarianism is a view about how delegated authority is supposed to be exercised in a particular sphere. It's not influenced by eschatology. So when we talk about delegated authority within the civil sphere, which is, you know, this kind of Christian nationalism debate, eschatology doesn't matter, because we're asking the question, how has God delegated authority to be exercised and for what purpose in a particular sphere? And we've just moved from, you know, the sphere of the church or the sphere of the family over to the political sphere. And so, but if you start with this idea that, you know, it's a post-mill project, something like that, well, then, you know, the other point I like to make is who's written the most famous book on Christian nationalism? The card-carrying all-mill, right? So, and you keep seeing Stephen Wolfe get lumped in with the post-mills by the guys that don't seem to, maybe they...
Yeah, he thinks that's funny, but...
Yeah, and, you know, and I wonder, it's like, okay, I want to assume the best and assume you guys don't know any better, and you loop them in with the post-mills, but if you don't know any better, you probably ought not to be talking about this. But, you know, there's all these presuppositions that get brought in. So here's a contentious one. You know, the sojourner identity of the church. And here's what's really funny, at least for dispensationalists, I think this is terribly inconsistent. So you go to, you know, Peter talks about how we're, you know, sojourners and aliens, exiles. Well, Peter's the apostle to the Gentiles, or Peter's the apostle to the Jews. He's writing to the Jews of the diaspora. I mean, he literally says that, if you can, you know, you were trained in languages. Peter's writing to Jews who are literally still in the exile under the curses of the Mosaic covenant. They are kicked out of the land. They are dispersed from the land. And so he's writing to Jews who literally are of the, you know, exile. They're sojourners. They're not in their land. That's not me. The church is not in exile. Right. I have not been kicked out of my land, but dispensationalists often do bring in that, you know, sojourner ideology. And here's what's really funky. You know, you go back to Calvin was very clear that those first Peter, second Peter, it's written to the Jews. He's addressing the Jews, and that's the view throughout most of church history. And so you'd think if anybody would get it right, it'd be the dispensationalists. So we who say, listen, yeah, Revelation 21 says in the future, in the eternal state, there's nations and there's kings. It's pretty clear. We also see a future nation of Israel. So yeah, they are the diaspora. They are the exiles, the sojourners. You know, that's not the church. Dispensationalists ought to get that right, as those who were looking for that kind of regathering that God will do post-conversion of the Jews. So there's a lot of these, you know, ideas that come in, like, you know, the abrogation of the cultural mandate, right? If you think that the kingdom mandate, cultural mandate, dominion mandate, whatever you want to call it, if you think that that's been abrogated and no longer in play, then, well, then I don't have any obligation to engage culture. Right. But if you I think consistently the scripture indicates it is still in play, and there's dispensationalists that do believe and teach that that mandate is still in play. You know, one of my professors, Mike Vlock, would teach that. It's in the, you know, the MacArthur Mayhew systematic theology textbook that it's still in play. Psalm 8, David points out that, you know, that we're supposed to have dominion, and it's not yet completely fulfilled. It won't be fulfilled until Christ comes. But as dispensationalists, if we bring wrong ideas in, you know, even, okay, well, we lose down here, as you know, my pastor MacArthur is so famously saying, when do we lose down here exactly? I agree, there's a coming Antichrist. There's a coming one world system. But where was the turning point? Have things gone only downhill since the ascension? Was 1776, was that a low mark post-ascension, or was that maybe a high mark? And so, yeah, okay, yeah, we lose down here. But so what? What does that have to do with what I'm supposed to do right now? What does that have to do with faithfulness? What has God called me to do right now? So anyway, kind of a long ramble, but I don't know if that's helpful.
No, it is. You pointed out a few things. One is that the eschatology debate maybe cloaking some other actual disagreements. I think that's a good way to frame it, that there's there are disagreements within Christianity, right? Surprise, surprise. But to attribute them to this particular disagreement may not be accurate. Not everything functions. This is the way I look at it. Like some of the guys, and I don't see Amills like this, but there's some rabidly post-mill guys, not all post-mills, and there's some rabidly pre-mill and some dispensational guys, not all of them are like this, who will use their eschatology system like an ideology. In other words, like everything, it's like the cage stage Calvinists, like everything relates to it. They think they found the key that unlocks every door, and you know, this will just revolutionize every matter. And it doesn't. It's one area of theology and has one specific purpose. And they all actually agree on very fundamental things, that Christ is coming back. There is going to be a new heaven, a new earth. It's really their particular flavors of how we get there. Right. So, so yeah, those things can, you know, if you get to the point of just escapism, that's really the problem. That can affect you. If you get to the point of, you know, this is somehow, and I have heard guys articulate this, that this is part of the gospel for us to just take over every institution. And you can get into some dicey heretical waters there very easily and compromise what the gospel is. And so there's problems, but like the systems themselves, the eschatologies themselves aren't really necessarily the problems, even if they have tendencies attached to them. That's how at least I see it. So it sounds like you see it very similar to that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, because we're just trying to answer the question, what is the Lordship of Christ? The expression of the Lordship of Christ, what's it supposed to look like in this sphere? Now, if, you know, I'll say this gently, you know, if you need the crutch of thinking you're going to win to be faithful, then fine, go for it. Take post-mill position and, you know, you're going to triumph here and now. If you need that to be faithful, then fine. I don't need that. I don't, you know, in one sense, it you know, everything I do, whether it's as a father, as a husband, you know, as a churchman, as a pastor, whatever, as a citizen, I just want to be faithful, and I'll leave the results to God. I don't need to be encouraged by I'm going to have this particular result here and now.
Yeah. Well, and I guess even in that scheme, you're gonna win down here eventually. You're just training for coming back and ruling anyway, right? That's right. Kind of the so. No. You know, I've told guys this, that when I was in seminary and I did one semester at Masters, and then I actually transferred eventually to Southeastern, and that's where I completed my MDiv. And part of that was eschatology related. I actually wanted to explore other eschatologies, and they seem to have a wide breadth of eschatologies represented there. Okay. It didn't really help me straighten anything out, I'll be honest. I think I might have made a mistake, but if that was my only motivation there. But I ended up in this class, and in, you know, theology class, and we half the semester was eschatology and half was ecclesiology. And I remember the professor, Hammett was his name. He said, raise your hand, you know, for every different flavor of eschatology. And at the time I was going to, I had come from a John MacArthur type of dispensational church. And so I was kind of by default, I'm like, well, I mean, that's what I believe. So I raised my hand. There was only me and one other guy in the classroom. And we were also the most ardent creationists in the class. I was surprised at that. Okay. There's all these other like theistic evolutionists and so forth. So the post-mill crowd was much bigger than we were. The Amel crowd was much bigger. And I thought, what explains this? Because the Southern Baptists, before that, if you went 10 years back, they would have been primarily dispensational. The Southern Baptists were known to be more dispensational. And there was a change that was happening. And I know in my own church history study, sorry, I'm waxing long about this, but if you go back to the social gospel time, those guys were all post-mill. It's pretty much. I mean, there, maybe there's some exceptions and some Amel guys and stuff, but sure. Anyway, I've tried to point this out to guys and say, look, if you think that's the key, if you think like, hey, if conservatives are just, if Christian conservatives were just post-mill, that would solve everything. You got to understand this eschatology also has been used to further liberalism. And where I was, which was a very social justice leaning seminary, they were all rejecting dispensationalism. And sometimes they would articulate it in such a way that that was the thing keeping the church back from social justice. So it's almost like two sides of the same, like one's arguing for a more right-wing approach, one's arguing for a more left-wing approach, but they're both saying that the key is in their eschatology. And so I just never really bought that. I was like, okay, it can't be that. It's got to be something else that's causing this. So here's the question I have for you, I guess, at the end of that. What do you think is the determining thing? And this would, if there is a thing, maybe it's more than one thing. And this goes for a relationship of church and state, as we saw in COVID. This goes for even now the arguments over whether or not you can have a government that self-identifies as Christian or, you know, reinforces Christian laws, the cultural Christianity debate. What makes someone line up more on the right on those things and say, no, we have, you know, the government can't do this to the true church. And yes, the government should be advocating Christianity. If it's not eschatology, what is it?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's so, you know, I did a 40-part sermon series on God and government, and, you know, I'm slowly working that into a book. And one of the most difficult things is that there's so many threads that have to be woven together. So, you know, if you get your, if your anthropology gets thrown off, you're gonna mess things up. You know, if your understanding of divinely delegated authority and the limits gets messed up, you're gonna end up with error. You know, so you're trying to make a, you know, a 25-sided design, 25-sided stop sign. And, you know, if you get one side off, you're gonna throw off every other side. And so, and that's even where, you know, looking at guys that are fringe on whether it's post-mill, all-mill, pre-mill, whatever, you know, just argue the actual theology rather than the fringe guys. I can find fringe guys to blame all kinds of stuff on. But yeah, so, you know, if you get anthropology wrong, and that's what we saw, I think 2020, you know, the mantra was, well, they're just looking out for our best interests. Anybody with a biblical anthropology was saying, why would you believe that?
Right.
You know, and what we found out eventually was that no, they weren't looking out for our best interests. I mean, it was totalitarianism, you know, like crazy. So the logic I've used, John, is and I did some of this in the series I'm doing, the biblical basics of political theology. You know, whenever God creates spheres, so sphere of self, you start there. Sphere of family. And remember, I'm a long-winded preacher, so you can interrupt at any time.
You're good.
when God creates a sphere, you know, there's a structure to the sphere. So you think of the family as the simplest one. It's got a structure, husband and wife, right? Not two dudes, not two women. The husband is the head of the wife. It's got a teleology. It's got a purpose. It's got a direction. And so there's a structure, there is a purpose, and tied into that's also a definition. Well, as soon as the fall is introduced, man goes sideways and every sphere gets corrupted in its purpose, in its definition, in its structure. And so you think in our country, if you know, there's so many threads here. Okay, let me argue it from this angle. You think about our Declaration of Independence. All men are created. So now we're a Christian worldview. They're created by their creator. They're given certain inalienable rights. Okay, you know, I would argue that if you can't affirm that, you're not even American, right? The basis of being an American is the idea that there is a creator and he has given inalienable rights, and it's the job of the government to secure those rights. And so, you know, I've argued God, by virtue of his person, is he alone has rights, and he has the right to be obeyed, to be worshiped, to be loved. And that creates in us obligations. We have obligations to obey, to worship, to love. Now, since I have an obligation to obey God and to worship God and to love God, therefore I have the right to do that. No other sphere can come along and take away those rights. Now, I can forfeit them and you know, forfeit my life, but I have the right to life. I have the obligation to represent God. By virtue of being made in the image of God, I have the obligation to represent him, and I have the obligation to worship him, and therefore I have the right to do those things. But as soon as the fall is introduced, you're going to have corrupted teleology, corrupted definitions, and we're seeing that with, you know, all the trans stuff, corrupted definition of what it means to be human, transhumanism even. Well, think about the civil government. So I've got corrupted individual spheres entering into the civil government. And if God's intention in the civil government was, and this introduces another rabbit trail, there's those who are going to argue that civil government is a, you know, a post-fall institution. That's a problem. Because in the eternal state, Revelation 21, the New Jerusalem comes down, there are kings and there are nations, and the kings are bringing the glory of the nations into the New Jerusalem. So in glory, we still have distinct nations and we still have kings. So we still have civil authority post-glory, which means it's going to be really hard to argue that nations and civil authority, civil government, are a result of the fall. If they're a result of the fall, why are they not reversed in glory? And what's really interesting is you think about marriage apparently is going to be dissolved post-glory, right? They're not given or received in marriage, and yet we're going to have kings and nations. So if God's given the civil magistrate the sword in this era post-fall for punishing evil, well, if man's corrupted, then he's going to corrupt the sphere of civil government. And if education, think about the role of education. So I'm kind of dancing. I'm illustrating my point of having to thread all this together. So we have the right to education because we have the obligation of education. So parents, education is a familial obligation. Parents are obligated to teach their children two things. Spiritual matters, right? Worship of God, who he is, who I am. And then horizontal matters, right? How to interact with this creation, how to be faithful in representing God to the created sphere, you know, being a profitable member of society. And so the family is obligated to teach that to their children. Therefore, they have the right to teach that to their children. But if the family is made up of corrupted individual spheres, they're no longer going to use education for that purpose. They're going to teach a wrong view of God. They're going to teach a wrong view of self. They're going to teach a wrong view of what you're supposed to do with this creation. And then what happens is those corrupted spheres of family continue to corrupt the individuals they're raising even more. Those individuals then get into the civil government. And, you know, the civil government then is going to be tied together with the education system, such that now what happens is the family creates these corrupted spheres that don't properly recognize God's authority. Those individuals go into the government. Now the government doesn't recognize God's authority, right? They become statist. And so then the schools that are created become statist, right? Statism is the idea that essentially there's no higher authority than God. It's basically the state defines rights, it grants rights, it can suspend and even retract rights because they're not accountable to God. So these spheres of self that are corrupted go into the civil government. They don't recognize God's authority. And then they're going to co-opt the schools and control what the schools teach in a self-perpetuating way. And so before you know it, you wake up and it's the year 2020 and everybody in America is a statist. And so, and that's the view that, hey, the civil government says, shut down your church, you shut down your church because, you know, the state has essentially ultimate authority. And then the Christians say, well, you know what, we'll carve out one little section where Caesar doesn't have authority. He doesn't have authority in the teaching of the word and the doing of ordinances. But other than that, he can tell you whether you open or close and all those types of things. So, you know, that's a really long way of answering your question. But if you get education, the purpose of education wrong, if you get your anthropology wrong, you get your, you know, divinely delegated authority wrong, there's, you know, death by a thousand cuts here.
We interrupt this podcast with a message about one of our sponsors. Are you concerned about what your children are reading? Mudhen Mama understands how difficult it can be to find books that align with your family's values. That's why they've carefully curated a collection of quality books for the whole family, from preschool to adults. Mudhen Mama offers an alternative to traditional book fairs, selecting books that celebrate truth, beauty, and goodness. With a wide range of genres, including classic literature, biographies, historical fiction, and more, their mission is to provide literature that fosters character and virtue in readers of all ages. Founded by Michelle Lazor, a mother of 10, Mudhen Mama is committed to empowering parents to guide their children's hearts and minds through thoughtful, faith-filled reading choices. For families looking to fill their shelves with books that educate, inspire, and reflect their values, visit mudhenmama.com today and discover the perfect book for every reader. Mudhen Mama, where literature meets faith and values, without the Darwinism, critical race theory, and liberal agenda. Use the code Harris to get 10% off your order. Go to mudhenmama.com today. Now, back to the podcast.
I see. So it's not just one thing in your mind that...
Yes, the short way of putting it.
Yeah, there's a number of things. And understanding your man, his role, you used spheral authority there, his relationship to God and God's expectation, then will channel you into a correct posture in your political theology. Now, I guess where I'd want to take this next is we already briefly touched on the whole the government cannot, according to Romans 13, at least, they cannot use their delegated authority to stop true worship from taking place, because the church is a separate institution with separate responsibilities, and they have a right because there's a responsibility to worship. There's a few things I want to talk to you about, but one of them is I actually sent one of your messages to someone who I was having a conversation with on Messenger, who is very adamant that the problem with these quote unquote Christian nationalist types is that they confuse the church's mission with their own political philosophy, and we should never do that. And so Christians, and this is where maybe the conflation takes place, but Christians should not be looking to the government for salvation. They should only take their efforts and put them into the institutional church. Anything else is idolatry of some kind. That's really what I was picking up from him. And I couldn't really reason him out of this. Because I said, well, look, you got Christian bookstores, you got Christian music, you got Christian conferences, I'm in a Christian family. My daughter's not saved yet in the sense that she's not put her faith in Jesus Christ, even though she is part of a Christian family. And we would say, in a sense, she's a Christian, I'm not Presbyterian, but she's a member of a family that operates on Christian morality and Christian traditions and these kinds of things. So in that sense, she's culturally, she would be a Christian, even though, yeah, she is not a Christian in a theological sense, and we desperately want her to be. She's only 6 months old, though. So, you know, anyway, that being said, no one has a problem calling my family a Christian family. No one has a problem calling a church a Christian church, even though there's weed among the tares. So why is it a problem for the government, because that's really what we're talking about, to be self-aware that they are Christian, whether on the local level or whatever level you want to take? Why would it be a problem, let's say, in the middle of Oklahoma, where 99% of the population is Christian, and there's Christians making up all the political roles, and they want Christian morality, and they don't want evolution taught in their school or whatever the issue is. They want to put up a Christmas tree. Why is it a problem to say we got a Christian government? I don't understand the hang up on that, but there's a huge hang up on that. And so maybe address that a little bit and work in where you think maybe this is going awry, according to anthropology or what some of these threads that you were trying to connect here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you made good points about, you know, Christian schools, you know, Christian movie producers, studios, things of that nature. We've traditionally not had a problem attaching that label Christian to things that operate under biblical principles. You know, one of the issues is that public education has been incredibly, incredibly revisionistic. You know, our think about the First Amendment. When the First Amendment was ratified, you know, we had states that had state churches and religious tests for office and blasphemy laws. Matter of fact, if you just Google Harvard Law Review, First Amendment blasphemy, it'll pull up a Harvard Law article where they talk about, yeah, blasphemy laws were in place all the way until about 1950. It was never viewed as incompatible with the First Amendment, only on the federal level. But I think it's just, we've not had to think about these matters. We've had, if we say it this way, we've had a generally benevolent government for the most part up until 2020. And that's why everybody was caught by surprise and they checked their anthropology at the door and just said, oh yeah, they have our best interests at heart. But there's just a lot of shallow thinking all the way around because we haven't had to focus here. So, nations are going to be religious. They just are, because people are by nature religious, right? We all have a worldview. And even again, you know, thinking politically, the Supreme Court has ruled that, atheism, agnosticism, those are religious views for First Amendment purposes. So we all have this religious worldview. The government is going to have a religious worldview. They're going to point us to a highest good. They're going to point us to, you know, what we're supposed to do. Is there a higher authority? Is there not a higher authority? Those are all spiritual claims, right? Where do our rights come from? How do we define good? How do we define man? Those are all ultimately spiritual claims. You know, they're not scientifically testable claims. And so the government will have inescapably a religious worldview. We have a whether it's pluralistic, you know, polytheistic, communistic, atheistic, naturalistic, materialistic, whatever. Every government has a worldview. The argument is that if they're going to have a worldview, and they will, they ought to then have a Christian worldview. And that's the foundation even of this country. There's a creator who, you know, gave rights to his creation, and it's the job of government to protect those rights. So it's just the inescapable fact that nations are religious. Now, and maybe if I were to ground that in scripture a little bit, and here's where, you know, I chide my fellow dispensationalists a little bit. You know, we like to talk about how we champion a literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutic. Okay, well, let's go to Psalm 2. When David wrote Psalm 2, the kings, they were essentially, you know, they were the mediators of divine blessing upon their nations. That's just Old Testament worldview, right? And so in Psalm 2, when David writes that, whatever the king's religion was the religion of the nation. It's just the way that it worked. So when Psalm 2 says for the kings to kiss the son, acknowledge the son, publicly worship him, serve him, obey him, judges of the earth, worship him, serve him, obey him, trust him, what would that look like politically for the nation? Let's just be consistent here. In David's day, that psalm would have meant that the king would have declared Yahweh to be the one true God, and the judges would have judged according to Yahweh's revelation to the degree that they had it. And so this is just how it's always been. Nations are religious. It's inescapable. Man's religious. And therefore, we ought to just be honest and point to the true religion. Now, and this is here's another faulty idea that gets imported in. And it was a Canadian, actually. I think it's, what is his name? Klaus Van Dam. It's Van Dam. I can't remember his first name. He's a retired seminary professor. Had wrote an article on principled pluralism. And he made some really interesting points about Israel. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know. I don't I don't think I've read him, but I know about principal pluralism. So I think probably some other guys got it from him.
Okay. Yeah. And there's some good and there's some bad there. You know, just like, I mean, I would be a neo-Calvinist in the Bovink flavor, you know, not the Tim Keller flavor. So, but, you know, he makes the point that think about Israel as a nation. You didn't have to convert to Yahwehism to join the nation of Israel. Or let me say it, to reside within that territory. Now, you couldn't participate in the festivals. You could be charged interest in a way that others couldn't. So there were certain laws. Most of the laws, you got equal treatment with the Israelites. But in some laws, you didn't get equal treatment. So you could enter in. You could live there. Right. You could be a sojourner. But you weren't required to worship Yahweh. And if you didn't, you know, actually become a proselyte, then you couldn't engage in the public worship. However, you weren't forced to worship. Nevertheless, you also couldn't publicly, you know, evangelize for your apostate religion, for your idolatry, right? So if you want to worship Baal, that's fine, but it's not going to be public and you're not going to evangelize for it. And that's a really interesting paradigm because it demonstrates that you could come and live in that land, and you're prohibited from blaspheming Yahweh, you're prohibited from praising Baal, but you're not forced to worship Yahweh. And there's a lot of people today who think that if the government says, you know, this gets into, you know, first table issues, civil magistrate enforcing the first table. There's a lot of people who think just shallowly that if the government enacts blasphemy laws, you can't blaspheme Yahweh, you're forcing them to worship Yahweh. No, those aren't the same thing. We can say, hey, because, well, think about it. We already have blasphemy laws in our country. There's things you cannot say. So all countries have blasphemy laws. There's a protected class. And so, you know, nations are going to have blasphemy laws, but that's not forcing people to worship. Now, totalitarian nations do force people to worship, where we were moving over the last 4 years to where you will affirm certain truths or you will be punished. You will affirm this ideology. but, you know, if our government says, listen, you cannot practice that religion publicly, that doesn't mean you can't practice it privately. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, forced conversions.
So, I mean, this is maybe a dumb analogy, but we just had snow. So I'm thinking about it. Like, there's some roads that don't get plowed immediately, right? You can't travel them in a snowstorm. And there's certain roads you can. They're plowed immediately. And so, I mean, I think of it this way, like the government with the communal fund that's given to them, they can plow the road, you know, figuratively speaking, the road to worship Christ, the road to true religion, that needs to be well maintained and plowed and people can travel on that road. But the roads that go to these other religions should not be ever maintained or encouraged or anything. They should just remain roads that should not be traveled down. At least state expenditures should not be spent on trying to allow people or, you know, privilege. And this is where the whole issue with Satan monuments and things come in giving invocations from the Temple of Satan instead of a Christian church, which is happening now, which is crazy, but it's happening. I mean, I just saw that in Cookeville, Tennessee, of all places, because I have some friends who live near there, they have this whole Christmas controversy over, I think it's a local coven or something what in the world? This is the middle. And I was just there. It's Bible Belt territory, but you know, the armies of darkness, the forces of darkness see an opportunity. And that's the logic they'll use. It's like, this is just about religious liberty. This is just, you have yours, I should have mine, right? It's equal. And I think it was Jay Sekulow years ago said, well, you know, the Satanists, they don't show up. So it's not a problem. And now it's a problem. So what now? You know, what are you going to say now? Unless you have some kind of a default, like this is who we are as an identity. We're Christian. Or we don't do the Satanist thing. Like, you're not going to be able to argue against it because there's no neutrality, really. I mean, fundamentally speaking, it sounds great but it only works in a society that's already monolithic in some way, that has a default religion. And then, you know, you could say neutrality all day long because the Satanists won't show up. But once they show up, then what do you do with neutrality? So.
Well, and we're inconsistent in that because think about it. Our country historically has not allowed Mormon marriage, polygamy. You know, we're not going to hopefully allow, you know, Muslim child brides. but that's their religious observance. So we already have, every nation has religious restrictions on what's tolerated and what's not. You know, and the reality is, as we, as Christians, you know, as you teach that the job of the church is not to get involved in politics, I say yes and amen. It's the job of the Christian to get involved in politics, not the church. But as Christians retreat, you know who's not going to retreat? Everybody else. And that's what you see actually in so, you know, we talked briefly about the cultural mandate. I like to emphasize the cultural mandate. I was trained under, you know, Mike Vlock calls it the kingdom mandate because of that that language there of ruling and subduing. Others call it the dominion mandate. I like to focus on the cultural mandate that God gives man. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. The reason I like the cultural mandate language is because fill, I am convinced, includes not just people. We tend to read it that way. But here's what happens. The next time you find that Hebrew word for fill, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. The next time you find that Hebrew word is in Genesis 6, when the earth is filled. And the it's not filled with people. It says it's filled with violence. And so the idea there is not just filling it with people, but you're filling it with culture. And that is part of what it means to be in the image of God. By design, we are culture makers. We create culture, and then culture helps shape us. And you see that in Genesis 4. This is where it's so important to go back to, you know, these early chapters of Genesis. And I love Answers in Genesis and, you know, great ministry. But I think there's been an overemphasis on some of the scientific stuff and a little bit of loss of some of the theological implications. But Cain's line, by design, not because they're worshiping God, they carry out the cultural mandate. You know, Cain and his son, they begin urbanization, right? Irad, they build a city. And then, you know, you get to Lamech, and Lamech has his sons. They invent the wind instruments. They invent the stringed instruments. They're doing specialized, specialized husbandry. They're creating metal instruments. So, you know, within seven generations, the cultural mandate is fully engaged. And, you know, by the time you get to Lamech's song in Genesis 4, he's writing the first, you know, gangster rap song, or he's writing a song about killing somebody. Oh, and some of the there's some speculations there that Lamech's introduced, then his sons are introduced in their accomplishments. And then it returns to Lamech's song. And there's some speculation that maybe he's using one of his son's instruments to write this song. That's why Genesis sets it in poetic form in your Bible. And then maybe he was using one of his son's metal instruments to carry out that murder. So the fallen line, you know, you got two lines of people. There's the redeemed line, and there's the sons of Satan, right? As Jesus would say, or as John would say, there's the sons of the devil and there's the sons of God. The sons of the devil are actively involved in doing the cultural mandate, because it's what comes naturally to them by virtue of being in the image of God. So they're going into every sphere they can, and they're carrying out the cultural mandate to the glory of their spiritual father by nature. They're corrupting every sphere they enter into. And, you know, that's what we're supposed to be doing as Christians, but we're supposed to be engaging the culture and creating spheres and creating systems for the glory of our spiritual father. But to the degree that we back away from that, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. And so the godless are going to fill that vacuum, and they're going to further corrupt and further corrupt. And so the way I've argued it is that the Great Commission comes along and subsumes the cultural mandate. So, you know, as an unbeliever, you were building out this world for your own glory, and you were doing it, as Ephesians says, you know, according to the prince of the power of the air, who's at work in the sons of disobedience. So every unbeliever is building out this world for his own glory. He's animated and influenced by the prince of the power of the air. And so he's carrying out that mandate to the glory of his spiritual father. Well, when the Great Commission comes, it comes along, we're regenerated, we're converted. And now we, in many ways, continue doing the same thing we've always been doing. But now we're doing it to the glory of our Father. So now we're building godly, God-honoring businesses and families and social clubs and religious institutions and educational institutions and political institutions. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. And that's what, because, again, that's what we naturally do by divine design. And to the degree that we're intentional about it or unintentional about it is the degree to which we're successful in representing God or unsuccessful in representing God. And then to the degree that we retreat from culture and retreat from building, it's just going to be filled in by the sons of the devil. And that's what we've really seen, I think, over the last 50 years. So yeah. Anyway, there you go. There's another long answer.
No, it's good. Good stuff. I want to ask you, especially with the dispensational belief, what do you think about the phrase Judeo-Christian?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Well,
to justify or just to imply that there's some kind of a league between Jews and Christians and that our government, I think it's a tip of the hat to the Old Testament, but it's also an invitation for Jewish people to kind of operate on an equal footing to Christians in the civil sphere.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that's a contentious issue right now, right?
A little bit. That's why I asked you.
No, and I'm more than happy to address it. I mean, I've addressed it on Facebook a lot, actually. I'm pinging on there all the time. I think this is an area where dispensationalists have been weak. So dispensationalist, I believe that in the future, according to Deuteronomy 30, Moses tells Israel, hey, you're going to disobey. You're going to be scattered. While you're scattered, Deuteronomy 31-6 lays out the terms and conditions and then the inevitability of the conditions being met. Essentially, when you're scattered and you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart, then he will regather you back into the land. So that tells us they are now scattered. They're now under the Mosaic Covenant curses. The Mosaic Covenant is obviously abrogated. It's gone. It's been replaced. It's obsolete. Hebrews makes that clear. You know, we have a new covenant. We have a new priesthood. But nevertheless, the promise of regathering isn't tied to the Mosaic Covenant. The promise of regathering is tied to the Abrahamic Covenant. So in the future, ethnic Israel will be regenerated, and then they will be gathered back into the land as a regenerated people. I mean, that's all throughout the Old Testament. And I don't want to pick a fight with my covenantal brothers. And so I'll just say that it's so clear, and all the Old Testament saints understood that's what God was promising them. And so was God intentionally misleading them that he was going to regather them into the land when they converted? Anyway, so what dispensationalists ought to be able to say is that modern Judaism, I don't care whether it's Rabbinic Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, Ultra-Orthodox Judaism, Reform Judaism, none of those are Old Testament Judaism, right? Old Testament Judaism ended with the Babylonian captivity. That brought us to Second Temple Judaism. And what we see today is not Second Temple Judaism, right? It's basically, Rabbinic Judaism. So we should be able as dispensationalists to say, yeah, whatever Judaism you see today, that's not biblical Judaism, right? There's no temple, there's no sacrifices, there's no priests. That is not the Judaism of Paul. It's not the Judaism of John the Baptist or Jesus or any of the prophets. This is a totally different Judaism. So we should be clear there. Also, I don't think dispensationalists should have a problem saying that the ethnic Jews are still under the curses of the Mosaic Covenant. They're still scattered. They've never been regathered. Ezra 9, Nehemiah 9 both make that clear in their prayers that they're still subservient, even though a remnant had returned. So they're still experiencing those curses. They are judicially hardened, according to Isaiah 6, and then Paul in Romans makes it clear they're still judicially hardened. They're still the same, with a few Messianic Jewish exceptions. They're still the same Christ haters, that murdered him, 2,000 years ago. And Jesus said that Jerusalem would be trampled by the Gentiles, until the end. And so God kicked them out. Jesus said Jerusalem's going to be trampled. God said he would gather them back after they corporately turned to him. Therefore, what you see as the modern nation of Israel back in the land isn't the biblical nation of Israel. Because the biblical nation of Israel that God has promised for the future is a regenerate national Israel, that they're first converted, again, Deuteronomy 31-6 or a bunch of other texts. They're converted and then they're gathered back into the land, and they're trusting Yahweh, right? In the Judaism of today, they don't trust Yahweh. They are explicitly anti-Trinitarian, right? They worship a different God. They don't worship the same God as we do. They've rejected God's own self-revelation. So modern Judaism is not biblical Judaism. Modern nation state of Israel, I would argue, I call myself a rabid dispensationalist. Modern ethnic Jews do not have a right to the land of Canaan right now. Their right has been revoked due to their covenant disobedience. And that right will be restored, according to the Abrahamic covenant, when they turn back to the Lord. So dispensationalists should be able to say the modern nation state of Israel, it's not the biblical Israel, they're totally apostate. They don't even have a theological right to the land. However, if they've been given a treaty or some sort of land grant that grants them that land, as happens in every other nation, you conquer or wherever it happens and you own that land, yeah, now you have a geopolitical right to autonomy and to self-protection, self-preservation. So they have those, kind of nation state rights as a legitimate nation. But that's not because they have a theological right to the land right now. And not only that, Genesis 49 makes it clear. There's, I think, 13 last days prophecies. Let me plug the Legacy Standard Bible. It's the only Bible that translate that Hebrew phrase consistently every time. I think there's 13 of them. You pull out the Hebrew Bible and look it up. There's 13 of them. Genesis 49 makes it clear all 12 tribes will be around in the last days. It's part of the regathering. And there's enough scattered Jews. Let me say it this way. You got to have all 12 tribes for the end. But there's enough scattered Jews that those who are in Israel right now, who are engaged, and even though they've been kicked out of the land, their regathering is an act of high-handed rebellion because they're not supposed to be there. They don't have a theological claim to the land right now. They should not expect divine protection because, again, as a dispensationalist, in the future, Israel's going to get purged even further, according to the Old Testament. And so they shouldn't expect divine protection either. There's enough Jews scattered still that current nation, I'm not saying it should not, that current nation should not be wiped out. But God could allow that to happen, and you still have enough ethnic Jews from the 12 tribes to be regathered in the future, just as God has promised he'll do. So I think dispensationalists, another long answer here, dispensationalists haven't done the job we should of delineating, what's true and what's not. And so then you get everybody looking at us like, oh yeah, you guys support the modern nation state of Israel because you think they have a right to the land and they worship the same God as us. No. So
yeah, anyway. there may be, I'm assuming the majority probably do believe that there's, yeah. And I don't know. I mean, that's why I said the phrase Judeo-Christian, because that seems to cut across even denominational lines. And even some eschatological lines, when it becomes a matter of practical politics, and I guess because of the number of and the representation of Jewish people in the government, there is a concerted effort to include and use the Israel issue also to try to widen the Republican base, if possible. Because there's right now, obviously, a weakness on the side of the Democrats with the pro-Palestinian contingent. So, hey, I'll just say it like it is, because this is how it is. There's a lot of rich Jewish people out there with money to give to the Republicans, and mm-hmm. They're in powerful positions as lawyers and politicians and the rest. And so I think that's where the pressure comes from, to trying to maintain not just a friendship, but give a privileged status to Jewish people. And the phrase Judeo-Christian, I think, has somewhat become representative of that using that phrase sure. is. And this is an innovative thing. This is a newer thing. This what you're not. George Washington never said Judeo-Christian, right? Anyway, if we had more time, we could talk more about it. I had one last question I wanted to ask you about identity, because I think this plays into the whole debate over Christian nations. And it's not the Christian part; it's the nations part. And I know we only have a few minutes here, but I was on a podcast recently, the Wrath and Grace podcast, with a guy named Nathan Anderson, and we were talking about. This Antioch Declaration. I don't know if you've seen that. It's not relevant for the purposes of this, but he was trying to make the point, and I've heard this point made by a number of post-Smithianomy guys before in their version of, I guess, what they see as Christian nationalism, that the identity of a nation comes solely from, some will say primarily from, but I get the impression more of them think it's solely from, exclusively from, the covenant. So they look at the covenant of Israel and how God, you could be part of the covenant community if you bowed the knee to Yahweh. Now, I've tried to point out there was a lot of limitations on this, and there was, you didn't automatically get integrated into every level of civil society. You didn't get land permanently, you know, 70 years or year of Jubilee, rather, it reverts. And, you know, there's laws like perpetual slavery for the foreigner, but not for the native. There's all kinds of things. But anyway, what they'll say is that it was all based on the covenant. That's the entire basis for your national identity. And I've seen what I think is a debate between, oftentimes it gets framed like natural law versus theonomy, but it seems to me, though, there are people, and I would put myself in this camp, that think the family I'm born into, I don't know if you believe this, but I think families are the kernel seed, the basis for nations. So the family I'm born into, or adopted into, as the case may be, I'm born into a family, but the family that I'm in, like, I don't have a choice. I never signed an agreement. You know what I mean? Like, they never said, John, you need to give us some assent here and come into the covenant of our family. Or, like, I was just born into it. It's a natural relationship that has obligations attached to it and privileges. And it's a blessing. It's wonderful. I think God set it up. I think scripture assumes this. But I think there's something similar going on with nations, that nations are also the extension of this kind of a relationship, and they work in their own best interests. And when you're born into a nation, you're not born into, you also have obligations that you didn't consent to. And so it's not like later in life, there's a covenant to find out if you're really part of this family necessarily, even though families do have certain habits and beliefs and music and all kinds of art, right? A culture, as you just explained. So anyway, I'm setting it up, for you to, I guess, take a swing at it either direction you want. I mean, do you think that our national identity is based in covenant, or do you think it's based in nature, or if it's not either of those, where does it come from?
Yeah, you know, this is part of the difficulty is you've probably got three or four different arguments all in play at once here. You know, one of the arguments being made is, can nations make a covenant with God other than Israel? And whichever case you want to argue, well, just show me scripture, right? I've seen a lot of arguments. Oh, no, you know, you can't have a covenant, you know, unless you're Israel. Okay, well, you know, show me that from scripture. Not saying, you know, I'm not opposed to making a nation making covenants with God. God always deals federally with nations. You know, I did several messages on that. You know, what the leader of a nation does, And that's how it works. Like, you know, I talk to my kids, what the father does in the home, the kids suffer or prosper. You know, if our president declares war, it's going to impact all of us. So God's always, you know, and God deals that way too. So biblically, we're trying to do a diachronic study, right, of nationhood. You know, Tower of Babel, post dispersion. Nations were ethnic people groups, right? And this is, okay, so you got a ton of people that can't differentiate between ethnicity and what's the other word? You know, I'm making race. Fun of those that can't. Race, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, and this is an important one. People need to be able to differentiate between ethnicity and race. You know, you can have, you know, two people of the same race with different ethnicities, and you can have two people of the, you know, it works both ways. So, and even, you know, our founders, and you can find this in the Federalist Letters, they all agreed, hey, we are a nation with one language, one religion, you know, one set of customs and cultures. That's how the country was founded. You know, if you don't like that, that's fine. If you want to argue for something different, that's fine. You'll have to prove that it works. I'll show you that it doesn't. Look around. But you know, going back to Genesis, yeah, you were born into that nation. It was according to your lineage. And then you could get up and move. You could change nations if you wanted to, in theory. But, you know, there's this concentric circles of obligation, right? To love my neighbor as myself, and I can't love everybody. And so I even you see this in the New Testament, you know, let us do good to all men, especially to the household of God. So the question of is a nation because you're born there, you're a citizen, or is it because you're, you know, you've affirmed a covenant? I think that by virtue of being born there, you're obligated. You've been given obligations to those people. If those people and their customs are at enmity with God, then your obligation to God supersedes those obligations, of course. Now, if an individual, so, and this is how I would argue for our own country, I have great difficulty in somebody being an American citizen who would reject the Declaration of Independence. If you don't believe that men are created by a creator and given inalienable rights, and it's the job of the government to protect those rights, how are we going to have a civil society together? We're going to fundamentally disagree about why I'm here, where I'm going, what is good, who is man, the purpose of government. So, you know, can I love you and care for you? Yeah, I can do all those things. But you can't even have a local church, a small local church, without a shared language. How in the world are you going to have a state or a nation if you are fundamentally opposed? And so if the nation has a constitution or a covenant or whatever, and you come to age and you realize, I disagree with this. Well, then in some ways you're going to be an enemy of the people, right? You're going to be an enemy of that nation. So I don't know. I know that doesn't really answer your question all that well, but you could even restate it based on what I've said and pin me down.
I want to know what you said, what you think about that. That's a big debate right now. And, yeah, I have my firm positions on it that I'm writing down, and actually I've written the chapter on it. It's coming out in my next book. But I think there's some overlap in what you're saying and what I've come to the conclusion on. And I do not root identity fundamentally, national identity, in a ability to assent to some kind of a covenant. I do think that is a natural thing. I think in a family, it's a natural thing too. It's easier to understand on that level, I suppose, because we are seeing a big attacks on the family, but I think we've had attacks on the broadly speaking, the nation for longer. And we've, in America, at least, we've really drunk deep from this proposition nation idea that nations really don't even exist. They're just these abstractions and you assent to them. And so at a family level, I think you can, there is room, you can, so if you have like a wayward child, you can look at that child like the prodigal son, right, and say he's actually still a member of the family. He has the rights of a member of the family, and those privileges were given to him at the point of birth, because he bears the last name and that kind of thing. Now you can embarrass, you can throw off those privileges, but you reject them. And then I think that does put you into a kind of like a situation where it's the father's grace in that story and the ability to accept back the son that allows him back into the fold. So I do think there is a way that you can reject your family and become an enemy of your family.
Yeah.
By attacking them, essentially attacking them at their root. So I understand what you're saying about, like, when you have a body politic that is bound together, and in part they're bound together by the fact that they've endured certain struggles, one of them being the American Revolution. And in that struggle, one of the core principles, and this is where, you know, the proposition nation guys would want to capitalize. So you just said principle. Well, I'm saying that there's our shared assumptions about life that nations have to hold in common. It's not just about politics. It's also about what kind of music are we going to use for our 4th of July parade, right? Like, things like that. Even it might sound trite and simple, but those things actually do come together for people to share a community together? What
think about a work ethic, right? If you go to a country where they take siestas in the middle of the day,
it's going to be a problem in New York where I live for sure. You're going to be fired pretty quick. Yeah. So yeah, there are these shared assumptions. Oftentimes you don't really examine them because you're just born with them. And so that said, I think that, yeah, like you can forfeit those privileges, but at the root, you're going to be messed up. Your identity, you're still going to have this piece of you that you take with you that is, you're part of the United States. Like if I moved to Canada right now or any other country, I think that the United States is actually more of an empire than a nation, but I'm a little bit of a mutt myself in a way. You were saying you moved around a lot, and I think it's part of our problem. I moved around too a little bit. I was born in California, raised in New York, but I got family in the Midwest and the South. You know, what do you do with that? And so culturally speaking, I'm probably more Californian than anything else, even though I was raised in New York because of my parents and you know, we did things a little differently. I knew we were different. But if I went to Canada or someplace very different today, and I said, I reject the United States, I reject my California upbringing or whatever, I'm going to have a problem. I'm going to be taking that with me. There's going to be a part of me I cannot change. It's set in stone. I was born into it.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm going to like ranch dressing on pizza. I'm sorry. You know, it's a California thing, but there's going to be certain things that you just can't shake me of them. And so I think it's more organic than anything. And that's where it gets confusing. It's not like a rigid thing that you can just say, you can, as a matter of public policy, you have to create rigid laws. But I think what, even in public policy, you're trying to reflect what actually is intrinsically there in reality. And what's there is something organic. You know it when you see it. I know a Southerner when I see a Southerner. I knew you were a Southerner, even though for some reason I thought you were from Canada. I don't know why I thought that. Someone must, I don't know. But the way you spoke.
It's the French last name.
That must be it. Yeah, right. So but that could be New Orleans, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know if that's where your family traces to, but you know, you moved around, but you were in the South. So you developed kind of a Southern twang in your accent. And I picked that up right away. Like, are you a Southerner, right? Like, if I came up with the 10 points of what it means to be a Southerner, if you fell short of two of them, are you still a Southern, right? Those are the kind of stupid debates in my mind that happen where it's like, no, it's something that like, it's something ingrained. It's something you know when you see. It's something that you can, it's hard for me to get a quantified list and an expansive, exhaustive list of what it means to be a Southerner, but I do know it when I see it. And if, you know, if you got to talking on a front porch with someone and you're joking and laughing, it would be more obvious, right? Like, so like that's the kind of thing I think we're talking about when we talk about families and nations. It's when you're at church, you're watching these kids walk, you know, whose parents they belong to, not just because of how they look, it's because of how they act. Because of a number of factors, you're probably feeling more than seeing. Sounds somewhat sentimental, I suppose. But anyway, I think that it is more rooted in these kind of like patterns of life, traditions, development over time. Obviously, ancestry has something to play in this. But so that's my position. Obviously, I'm giving my position and not yours now. But I think the side of the more theonomic post-mill side that wants to say that it's just a covenant and that's it. Like it only reduces down to a covenant. I just don't think they're taking into account all the other beautiful things God has put there to make people different. And so that's where I come down on it. But
no, I think you're right. I'd agree with you there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one thing that needs to be pointed out, and this is, you know, Rusty Reno helped with this. I'm certain you read his book, you know, in the post-war consensus.
Yes, yes.
You know, what we're experiencing in our country is a lot like what the Assyrians did, the Assyrian Empire. And so one of their, you might call it geniuses, the way they kept their conquered people conquered, this is where we get the Samaritans, right? So you go in, you conquer a people group. You take, you know, 75% of them out of that land. And then you bring in, you backfill that 75% with people from 8 other conquered nations. You destroy any homogeneity that there was there. And that's what the Samaritans are, right? They call
them Africans. That's absolutely true. Yep.
And so that's what's happening in this country. you're diversifying, you're watering down, you know, anything that binds people together, these cultures, you know. And so essentially it's a you know Assyrian Empire 2.0, and that gets into obviously open borders and all that. And so
no, that's an exact example I used actually in my book was the Assyrians. It's not a good thing in scripture. So
right.
Unfortunately, I have to run because I have another podcast thing coming up, but. It was good to talk to you about this, and I'm really glad that we had the opportunity. If people want to check out more on your work, they can go to where?
Yeah, on YouTube, How Shall We Then Think is my YouTube page, and there's a few different playlists on there. Dispy Primer on Christian Nationalism and Biblical Basics of Political Theology. But yeah.
All right. Well, with that, Chris LeDuc, we appreciate your time and God bless. Have a Merry Christmas.
Thanks, John.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.